Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, and welcome to the Tattered Cover. I want to thank you all for coming tonight, and thank you for your support of Tattered Cover and other independent bookstores around the country. We're very excited tonight to have Linda Greenlaw here with her latest book, Seaworthy, A Swordboat Captain Returns to the Sea. Many of you may remember Linda from her earlier works of nonfiction, The Hungry Ocean, All Fishermen Are Liars, and, of course, The Lobster Chronicles. They were all bestsellers. She was also featured in Sebastian Younger's film and book, The Perfect Storm. But if you haven't sampled her two mysteries, you are in for a thrilling treat with Slipknot and Fisherman's Bend. Also, besides being the only American woman swordfish boat captain, she's likely the only captain who has co-written a cookbook with her mother. And it is recipes from a very small island, and it's all things New England, lots of seafood, great blueberry recipes, and it's really a beautiful book. And with that, please help me welcome Linda Greenlaw.
Thank you. People who recognize the name Linda Greenlaw as that woman who survived the perfect storm generally imagine that I'm fearless and courageous, a leader of men. And I have to tell you, this morning at 7 o'clock, I was absolutely terrified when I was facing an audience of 100 professional women and had to give a talk. Give me a little storm any time. It was just incredibly nerve-wracking. But anyway, happy to be here. Glad you're here. I won't assume that any of you know much about me. Probably start with a little bit of background. Talk a little bit, maybe read, and definitely Q&A. That's fun for me at this point. I was raised on and off the coast of Maine, where boats and fishing are the way of life. And when I was at an age where most kids were learning to ride bikes, I was learning how to row. When 10-speed bikes were all the rage, I had my first 10-horse outboard. I had, like, this perfect childhood. It seemed at the age of 19 a very natural step for me to step aboard a commercial fishing vessel when I desperately needed money for college. Stepped aboard a sword fishing boat, headed off to the Grand Banks for 30 days, and absolutely fell in love with my life. I did finish college. I literally fished my way through school, fished every summer, every vacation. Anytime I had a chance, I was hitchhiking to Portland, Maine, get aboard a boat, see if I could make some money. The money wasn't the most important thing. What really was important was I really loved what I was doing. The money was good, because back in 1979, there was a lot of money in commercial fishing. So I moved my way up to the captain's chair in a very traditional way, and that was I stayed on the same boat long enough to become first mate. And when the owner of that boat bought a second boat, that was my first opportunity to be skipper. Skippered many boats over the course of many years in many different fisheries, but always returning to my first love, sword fishing. Tried something else, went back to sword fishing. Always returned to it. Well, the last 6 years of my first 20 years sword fishing, I ran a boat, the Hannah Bowden, and that's the boat featured in The Perfect Storm. And had a lot of success with that boat. It was the biggest boat, the fastest boat, the best equipment, enabled me to get the best crew, and was right at the top of my game, and thought, all right, this is about it for sword fishing for me. 38 years old. I thought it was time to go home to the little island off the coast of Maine, get married and have children, like all my girlfriends had done while I was offshore. Stopped sword fishing. It was great because I could still make my living at sea. I bought a lobster boat and a bunch of lobster traps. I said, well, this is cool. I'll settle down and can still fish. Well, I'm not married, don't have kids. I've learned that I am not flawed. My plan was definitely flawed. I moved to an island where there are three single men. Two are gay. Third one's my cousin. Didn't work. But that's okay. That's okay. I can live with it. So anyway, very early on in my new flawed plan of lobstering, The Perfect Storm was published, the book by Sebastian Junger. And people always ask, you know, how did The Perfect Storm change your life? And I know they're asking about the weather event, but the weather event didn't change my life. It was 1991. I continued to fish. But the book about the storm, really, I hold responsible for the way my life is today in many ways. Very generous portrayal by Sebastian Junger. I never miss the opportunity to quote him when anybody's listening. And now I have a little bit of an audience, so here we go. The Hannah Bowden is skippered by a Colby College graduate named Linda Greenlaw. Not only is Greenlaw one of the only women in the business, she's one of the best captains, period, on the entire East Coast, year after year, trip after trip. She makes more money than anyone. When the Hannah Bowden unloads her catch in Gloucester, swordfish prices plummet halfway around the world. I like that part. Pretty tough image for me to live up to, as you can imagine. Immediately after that book was released and became a bestseller, when people would meet me for the first time, if they were familiar at all with The Perfect Storm, after hello, the first thing I get was, we thought you'd be a lot bigger. People are genuinely disappointed upon meeting me for the first time. I end up like apologizing for not being bigger, which is kind of weird. Anyway, among other changes that that very generous portrayal brought my way was this. I got in from lobster fishing one night, and I had a message on my answering machine. Hi, Linda. This is Emily Bestler calling from Simon & Schuster. We've read The Perfect Storm, and we're really intrigued with this female fisherman thing you have going on. Do you want to write a book? And I thought, that sounds like work. No. I never even returned the call. Never even had the courtesy to call this woman back. I like the female fisherman thing I had going on and didn't have any intention of doing anything different. Well, within a week's time, I had three identical calls from major publishers in New York saying, we've read The Perfect Storm. Do you want to write a book? And I had to realize what an opportunity I was being handed. I mean, I have friends who would kill for that opportunity to have a book published. I mean, friends of mine write beautifully and they get rejection letters knowing full well that probably whoever sent the letter hasn't even looked at their material. So how lucky was I that I was not only being invited to write a book that would be published, but I was being offered money to take a year off from fishing to do so. So I stepped up to that challenge and I took a year off from lobstering. I wrote my first book, The Hungry Ocean. The most difficult thing I have ever done in my life, hands down, was writing my first book. It took a year to write it, and I don't know if you read the book or not. I will talk just briefly about the title, because the title sums up the entire first book of mine. The Hungry Ocean is from a Shakespearean sonnet, but what it means to me is the ocean's ability to totally consume. I've been fishing for nearly 30 years now. And I've been consumed by it. I know it sounds cliche to say you're drawn to or taken with something, but I like the way I feel when I'm at sea. I am passionate about catching fish. So there's The Hungry Ocean. Nobody was more surprised than I was when The Hungry Ocean became a bestseller. And with that success came opportunity for another book. That book did well. I wrote another book. Okay, fast forward, 6 books, 10 lobster fishing seasons, 10 years. The whole 10 years that I was writing and book touring and lobstering, I was thinking of myself as a sword boat captain, thinking I'd go back to it, thinking next year I'll go, next year I'll go. I really love it. I can't wait to get back to it. And I had opportunity, but the timing was never right. You know, somebody would call and say, you know, there's a boat in Puerto Rico or there's a boat in Newfoundland. But either I had 800 lobster traps in the water, can't just leave them, or I was on like a 60-city book tour and I couldn't just like bail out in the middle of that. And I knew that the more time marched on, the less likely it was that I'd ever return to my first love, sword fishing. So 2 years ago, got a phone call, and a friend of mine, Jim Buddy, who manages 4 boats, said, okay, you know, there's a boat in New Bedford, Massachusetts. We need a captain. And I became entirely irresponsible and said, I'm going. And it got to a point where it was too late to sort of back out of it. And I was really nervous at the risk I was taking. I know people think of commercial fishing and you think risk, yes, it's the dangerous, you know, most dangerous job probably in the world. It always tops that list of dangerous jobs. But for me, that's not what I had in mind when I talk about risk. What I thought I was risking was my identity. The 10 years that I wasn't sword fishing, if I was introduced as a best-selling author, I was actually embarrassed by that. To this day, if I introduce myself to anyone, I introduce myself as a commercial fisherman. That's the title of my new book, Seaworthy. All my life, seaworthy has been the most complimentary adjective that I can aspire to or attribute to someone else. And it seems kind of silly. You know, why is that so important? But it just always has been. What do I mean by that, seaworthy? Well, did I still, you know, going back at the age of 48, did I still sort of have the things that I had when I was young? When I was 19 and first started fishing, I was told all I needed was a strong back and a weak mind. And those two things suited the job to a T for many years. 10 years later, going back as a very middle-aged woman, my back wasn't as strong, but I like to think that my mind was stronger. So the question I had was, does what you gain in maturity compensate for what fades with youth? My answer to that, when you read Seaworthy, I hope you'll agree, is that yes. In my case, yes. I refer to this trip that I write about in Seaworthy as a 56-day epic disaster. And usually in Q&A, people are very quick to ask me about my arrest, and I do talk about that extensively in Seaworthy. And it's I don't know, it's sort of almost refreshing that the questions about my arrest have actually now outnumbered the questions about my love life. Equally uncomfortable, but that, you know, okay. So anyway, does anyone have questions yet? Or I can just keep talking. Yeah, go. No, okay. If you do, just like stick a hand up, because I'm. Who's my boyfriend? Yeah, go ahead.
You said you were scared going from the book tours and authoring back to fishing. I can't imagine fishing from when you're 19 and then all of a sudden all these phone calls, you just drop that for a year. How scared were you to go do something completely new, like writing a book? It seems backwards.
Yeah, you know, it probably does. I had real confidence in my ability to write. And, you know, where did that come from? I majored in English in college. That certainly doesn't make me a writer. I didn't take writing courses. I majored in English because I enjoyed reading. And I knew that if I, you know, could take courses that I could write essays, I could get through college. I actually, okay, where'd this confidence come from? I actually had a blue book exam handed back to me one time where the professor had written on the outside in red ink, "Ms. Greenlaw, you are very unfamiliar with the material in this course. Well written, B plus." I was like, okay, I can write a book, don't worry about it. So, you know, but, you know, having said that, I was very confident that I could do it. I was offered a ghostwriter or a co-writer, but, you know, what's the point in that? If, you know, so I wanted to do it myself. Like I said, it was the most difficult thing I've ever done. What was even more difficult than that was my first book tour. I spent a year writing The Hungry Ocean, my first book, and had never met my editor. It was always on the telephone to New York City, and finally the book is done. It's time for me to, you know, go greet the public, and the publishers want to get a look at me. They want to meet me, so they said, well, we're going to fly you to New York and introduce you to everyone around. Hyperion at the time was my publishing house. So I said, all right, and I was pretty excited. You know, I'd never been to New York City before, and my friends on the island were teasing me, you know, about the Clampets and Beverly Hills and all this stuff, but I was pretty excited, and, you know, I'm in New York City, and I'm on, like, the 32nd floor of I don't know how many in this big office with my editor, Will Schwelby, and we're just kind of getting to know each other, just really making small talk because we'd only been on the phone before. And somewhere in the midst of our conversation, the phone on Will's desk rings, and he answers it, and he says, oh, you know, I can't talk right now. I'm with Linda Greenlaw. And I'm thinking, wow, that's... how cool is that? You know, you know, he's got to hang up because I'm here. Well, my ego was very quickly deflated when he described me to the person on the other end of the phone as adorable. And I thought, Okay, I've been called a lot of things. Adorable really has never been on the list. Well, I didn't really like it. You know, I thought, wow. I was hoping for almost anything else, but not adorable. Well, I said, I'm not going to rock the boat. I really like this guy. I'm not going to say anything about the adorable comment. I'll just let it go. And later in the day, I kind of was wishing that I had said something because he kept repeating it. Like, he's introducing me to people as his adorable author and things like that. Well, that night, it was really annoying me. That night, we had dinner with, I met my publicist. She came to dinner, a really nice young girl. And Will Schwelby excused himself from the table, and my publicist is like, oh, you know, how do you like Will Schwelby? Isn't he great? You're so lucky. He's the best. I said, yeah, you know, I really like him, but I've got to tell you, this adorable thing, I don't like, it's not setting well with me. Oh, she started cracking up. She's like laughing. People at other tables are looking like, what is so funny over there? She finally pulled herself together enough to speak, and she's like, he's calling you horrible, as in able to do book tour. It's like, oh, okay. Well, so that was a little, the first indication to me that I had stepped into a world of which I knew nothing, right? I really got off on a tangent on that one. I can tell some stories, but so anyway, yeah, that was. And I went back to my little island with my new identity of tourable author and started getting very nervous about the book tour itself. You know, I was going to go on the 60 cities in 60 days and, you know, places I'd never, anywhere I had ever been was by boat, you know, in a fishing port or something. So I was like really nervous about that. And I got the same advice from everyone. Oh, you know, all you have to do is be yourself. Everyone's going to love you. It's going to be great. And so, you know, I said, well, that's probably pretty good advice. And I went and did my first book event. And the next day, my publicist called and said, we've set up some media training for you. I was like, okay, myself wasn't exactly what they had in mind. I'm not even talking about my book. Oh, well, who cares? You can read it. So then the media training thing was actually good because it gave me something sort of brand new to feel nervous about. It's like, okay, now I'm not nervous about book tour. Now it's like discouraging that the publishers don't really think I'm fit to, you know, greet the public on their behalf. So, yeah, I went to this woman's house. She was in Boston. She's a media trainer. And, you know, I knock on the door and she says, oh, you know, come on in. I'm on the phone. And I go into her house and I was like, oh, wow, this is going to be cool. Like, she had one room set up, like, to do mock interviews with television camera and all this stuff, and I had some, like, national media coming right up. Another room set up for, like, book signings and things like that. So anyway, the woman gets off the phone. She took one look at me, and she took me to Bloomingdale's, and she took me to, like, the cosmetic department, and she explained to the supermodel who worked there, oh, you know, this is an author, and she's, you know, like, going on book tour, and she needs television makeup. So I had, like, national TV, like, the next day. Well, I didn't know what television makeup was, but supermodel knew exactly what it was. And she started, like, pulling stuff out of everywhere, drawers and off, and just, like, big pile of stuff on top of the glass counter. And I guess my eyes were getting, like, big, and she said, oh, you know, don't worry, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to buy all of this, but what do you use now for makeup? And I said, well, chapstick. And so, yeah, and the women laughed, both, you know, the media trainer and the, you know, supermodel are, like, laughing, and I'm like, no, I'm not kidding, right? I don't care what CoverGirl says, it's probably not going to stay on my face during my normal day. Anyway, media training was somewhat of a waste of the publisher's money, I think, because I spent, like, the woman put so much makeup on my face, I spent, like, all day sort of, like, looking for a reflection anywhere, anything that would show my face. Like, wow, this is, like, weird. It's, like, even on my neck. I thought, shit, I'm not going to be able to do this myself. I should have taken notes. And maybe I could national TV the next day. Maybe I'll sleep on my back tonight, and it'll be fine, or, you know, get my sister to come to Boston and put the makeup on me. She knows how to do this stuff. Anyway, so it wasn't really too good. Media training. I shouldn't say that media training was, like, a total waste of my, okay, this, I'm getting to the end of this, honest. I shouldn't say that it was a total waste of time and money, because the media trainer did explain about book events and bookstores and that you should really talk about your book. And you know, read and sign books and be really, you know, when somebody wants a book personalized, you really need to ask how to spell their name, because nobody wants to, you know, buy a $25 book and then have you screw it up when you personalize it, because so many different ways to spell the same name. So I had all my new training in mind, went to my very next book event, somehow got through the talk and Q&A, sat down to sign books, and the very first guy in line wants his book personalized. And I said, yes, you know, how do you spell that? And he said, B-O-B. I'm like, yeah, okay. And he's looking at me like, really, you wrote this book? I was like, yeah, okay. So I'm hooked on phonics. If you want a book personalized, you better tell me how to spell your name because I'm not asking. Okay, I really got off on a tangent there. This is why I have notes that I never look at. So I very seldom talk about some. I've actually done whole book signings without even saying the title of my book. I think we've already covered that, right?
Seaworthy,
thanks. Okay, any questions? You get me back on track here, yes?
So if you could be like a spokesperson for some nonprofit or something like that, which one would you pick and what would your message be?
Okay. If I could be a spokesperson for, does that have to be a nonprofit?
No.
Okay.
Well,
I think I would probably create one that just promoted U.S., maybe not just U.S. products, but in particular U.S. caught fish, and really try and educate the public about, people are so afraid to eat certain types of fish. I mean, apparently there's some kind of card that and if it's a green next to the fish, it's okay to eat it. If it's red, you shouldn't eat it. If it's yellow, eat it with caution. And I think that's just really bad. I think you need to throw those cards away. You know, there's two reasons that people give me or ask about. It's either mercury or overfishing. Those are the two things people always ask about. Should we be worried about the fish stocks? Well, you know what? There's a lot of good news in the fishing industry. And U.S. fishermen are the most highly managed, monitored, regulated fishermen on the planet. If it's available to you, it's been through a lot of scrutiny, and you should eat it and feel good about it. The fact that there are groups of people warning people not to eat certain types of fish really bothers me. I mean, we're fatter than we've ever been as a country. And the number one killer of women in this country is heart disease. I mean, swordfish is like in the top 10 for omega-3 fatty acids. I mean, it's really good for you. It's really healthy. So I think, if I were to do something, that would be my message, you know. Eat fish, make sure it's caught by U.S. fishermen. We're held to much higher standards as far as just our fishing practices. You know, we're more environmentally friendly, we're greener, we're all of those things than some of these really inexpensive imports that are coming in. So, you should ask where the fish is caught and buy U.S. caught fish. Yeah, thanks. That was a good question. Yes.
So, Linda, you have a really great sense of humor. I mean, does that really help you when you're out on a boat for like a couple of months with the same folks? And because your book was very funny.
Thanks.
Machado.
Yeah, he's wicked funny.
The way you described him and the Kit Kat. And
he is the funniest man I've ever met. I mean, bar none. He should be on TV. He is so funny.
And Archie was funny too, especially that merchandising comment. I thought that was the funniest thing.
It was the perfect bunch of guys for that trip, because whenever things were bad, which was most of the time, they were just,
they were funny.
They were joking about it and taking it very lightly. And I tell you what, that beats the long faces, because I think the hardest thing as a captain is to try and bring, you know, morale up of the crew when the chips are really down. Bad weather, poor fishing, things breaking down. I didn't have to worry about it with these guys. They were, you know, cheering me up. So it's good. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes. Yeah, actually, we've already sent all the recipes in, and I have this break in my book tour that I get to go home, and we're doing the photography on the island during that break.
That would make a lot of fun.
You know what? It was really fun to have a major project to do with my mother. I mean, I'm a tomboy. I've always done stuff with my dad. And so to have, you know, this beautiful cookbook to show for, you know, something that mom and I did together. And my mom was 70 she just turned 70. And my mom, you know, she raised four kids and she was a stay-at-home mom. And it was pretty cool. The only money she ever had was what my father gave her. So when you write this cookbook, she gets a check. She's like, wow, I like this. And So we're having fun working on the second one. We just got emailed today that the shot list of what we need to do while I'm home. And there's going to be a whole lot of cooking going on. So that'll be fun.
Yeah, do you ever take her with you on your book tours?
When we promoted the cookbook, we toured together for 6 weeks.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and it actually was, and it's fun and funny because every store we went to in the course of 6 weeks, somebody would pull me aside and say, what's it really like to be with your mother? And somebody would pull her aside and say, come on, really, with your daughter this long? And it was, so we'd like compare notes at the end of the night, you know, somebody asked me that too, again. So it actually was fun. My mom's a good friend of mine, so it worked really well. Yeah, thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.